Raise your hand if you heard the name Jerry Rice. That's pretty impressive. There are some who are even the generation behind me who raised their hand anyway. I think that his last season in the NFL was in the late 90s. So he is widely regarded as one of the best football players of all time. He had good size at 6'2", 201 pounds. But neither his size nor his speed nor any of those sort of tangible attributes were exceptional. Many of the things that made Jerry Rice exceptional were the things that he cultivated, not just the things that he inherited. For instance, he was an exceptional route runner. He would do double and triple moves in order to create separation from defenders. And no matter how disciplined the defensive back might be, it is really difficult to stay in the hip, as they say, of an offensive player when he's juking you at a high rate of speed, much so to do so while he makes repeated efforts to get rid of you. Jerry Rice could take over a game, and Jerry Rice was a receiver. Receivers play offense in football, and I think in life too. The best receivers would think of their game planning in terms of attacking defensive backs. They would game plan in such a way as to get them off their step right at the line of scrimmage, and then the defensive back would be at their mercy. And this is interesting when the effectiveness of a wide receiver, really depended on whether or not the quarterback gave him the ball. Receivers, make no mistake, are weapons. And though he is at the mercy of the quarterback to get him the football, the receiver is important, nevertheless. In fact, it'd be silly to suggest otherwise, to suggest that just because his role is to deal with whatever it is that he is given, that he's of less importance. He's what they call a skill player, one of those who's tasked with touching the ball in any given play. And Jerry Rice would make it his aim to exhaust defensive backs, even on running plays. On running plays, when he was nothing but a decoy, he would get the defensive backs out of the play by sprinting down the field, making them chase after him just to take that guy out of the play and to exhaust the defender. Keep him guessing, keep him guessing, keep him guessing. But the receiver is important, receiver though he may be, and he has work to do to get himself in position to receive well. And in doing so, as a guy who's played quarterback at recess a few times, I can tell you that a good receiver can make the quarterback's job an absolute delight. And he can make a defensive back's work maddening and frustrating. I've seen plenty of games where it seemed like the defense had no answer for that receiver, and where a receiver took over a football game because you just knew that the quarterback was going to drop back, close his eyes, and just hawk the ball as far as he could, and there was nothing the defense could do about it, but that receiver was going to come down with it. That is called weaponized receiving. Likewise with feasting. Feasting is weaponized receiving. And tonight we're continuing our study of building and battling in the negative world. And as Sean mentioned, in May, my thoughts turn even more than typical to feasting. I got to talk about it at our assembly last Thursday, and even some of the thoughts I have tonight are similar to what I shared then. Indulge me, not all of it's the same. I've written about it, lots of Mays, as we get ahead of the fundraising feast, which is far more about feasting than it is about fundraising. And I just believe that this is such an important part of the culture that we're trying to develop here. And as we're looking to build and battle in the negative world, the sort of culture that we are looking to build here in our lifetimes is a Christian community of jealousable worshipers. And they will evidence that jealousability. They will evidence that they have been blessed by God and will make that blessed life look good. Their lives will provoke then the right sort of jealousy among a dying generation around them. Others will want the blessings that we have, that these jealousable worshipers enjoy. And a feature, I believe, of such a community is that they will know how to feast. Now, the coming generation of jealousable worshipers will feature then frequent, and I'm suggesting, formidable feasting. But most immediately, this formidable feasting, here and now, will help us to build the sort of community we're talking about. So let me say that again, to be clear. As I'm talking about formidable feasting tonight, I'm talking about something that I believe will be a feature of a jealousable culture that we're trying to build later in our lifetimes, but down the road. But I also am suggesting that practicing formidable feasting and being formidable feasters will be something that will help us to get there. So it is a device for building and battling here and now, not just in our hearts, but in our world. I'm going to consider this tonight under two big headings. First, I would like to look at the features of formidable feasters, as in the persons themselves, and then I'd like to consider features of formidable feasting, as in the practice, the act of feasting itself. But first, perhaps it would be helpful to identify what we mean when we say formidable, and I will not try to improve upon the dictionary definitions from Oxford and from Merriam-Webster. So first, Oxford says the formidable means inspiring fear or respect through being impressively large, powerful, intense, or capable. And the notion of that describing our feasting excites me. The notion of that describing our persons excites me. According to Merriam-Webster, it means something I think even more fun. It's got a threefold definition. First, causing fear, dread, or apprehension. Second, having qualities that discourage approach or attack. And then third, tending to inspire awe or wonder, impressive. So, formidable is an adjective that applies to both the people and the practice of feasting. So first we're going to look at the features of formidable feasters. In Psalm 23, verse 5, David says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." Surrounded by the enemies of God, David worshiped. And his worship involved receiving with intentionality from the hand of God. David absolutely terrified his adversaries. And why? David was a formidable feaster. He was marked by the attributes that I'm suggesting here. What sorts of things are we talking about? Well, the ECS other graduation requirements provide us a pretty good list, and I'm not going to try to improve upon that, just like I'm not trying to improve upon the dictionary definition for formidable. So I'm suggesting six attributes that should sound familiar to many of you. First, formidable feasters are stout because they require a substance of character. I already mentioned that a generation, a community of formidable feasters will really know how to feast, and their feasting, that is not the same thing as partying. It's more than that. Their feasting is not shallow, empty-headed, vapid partying like the world does. It's not this sort of hedonistic affair that the world champions so much, that they advertise in the beer commercials and so much. In fact, that is as much like feasting as balsa wood is like iron. Formidable feasting, rather, than flows from a character that is weighty and mindful. You can't be a flyweight and feast well, and I'm not talking about how well you hold your alcohol or your pot roast. I'm talking about substance. I'm talking about what praise from you means. So, a person of character who confers a blessing or a compliment has more effect than a liar who gives a compliment or a blessing. And what does praise to God from you mean? Praise from the righteous, from the godly, is more than praise from the wicked or ungodly. And the feasting of a stout feaster, likewise, means much more. So, a formidable feaster must be stout. I also would argue that a formidable feaster is generous because he knows that it is more blessed to give than to receive. If you are selfish, your feasting will never be formidable. Feasting comes from a generous heart. Gluttony comes from a selfish heart. And if you come to the banqueting table selfishly, whatever it is that you're doing, it's not feasting. Generous people are ready givers of themselves and of their resources because they understand that all the good things that they enjoy are undeserved blessings. This is the gospel. And people who are properly oriented to understand grace are themselves gracious. They are big-hearted and generous. Third, formidable feasters are copious because it's impossible to feast too much. Copious means abundant in supply or in quantity. Formidable feasters feast a lot. And while feasting is work, it is way more work to have the right heart than it is to have the right menu or the right place settings or to make sure that the meat is not overdone. If feasting is weaponized receiving, and I'm suggesting that it is, and if it's receiving good gifts in such a way as to show off the giver of those gifts, can this be done too much? So, remembering that feasting is more than eating, it's easy to make a distinction. Overeating is easy. Overfeasting is impossible. Formidable feasters are prodigious because God's blessings are great. They are great in expanse. Prodigious means remarkably or impressively great in size, extent, or in degree. In the Old Testament, the feast lasted for a week. And I'm not suggesting necessarily that we try to do that, although if we did, it would gain the attention of the watching world. Still, feasting involves food, and it's more about a mindset than it is about the menu. Mindset over menu. And while that may be the case, it is also a fact that a Big Mac is just not as compelling as a steak. In other words, while fast food has its place, it's all lawful, that's fine, it does not require the same level of feasting copiousness that is required of a steak, of tri-tip, smoked chicken, chocolate cake, and whiskey. Receiving these things well receives some muscle, some skill, some care. Formidable feasting builds our worship capacity. So the practice actually enables us to be able to do more and also shapes us into certain kinds of persons. Frequent feasters become fit feasters, and fit feasters are formidable. Formidable feasting expands our worship capacity. It glorifies God. It roots us and it grounds us so that we're not easily blown about. And what else? Formidable feasters are thankful because they understand grace. The blessings that we enjoy are undeserved. And thankful is on the other side of the same coin as generous. And just as the generous man knows that it's more blessed to give than it is to receive, so likewise the formidable feaster recognizes that his thankfulness is itself a gift to the givers. So the way that you receive things that are given to you, not only by God, but even by other people, influences not only their enjoyment, but whether or not they ever give to you again. Right? Now, God is not stingy, but you have the capability of receiving well and being a vehicle of blessing you're doing so. How much more so when God is the giver of that gift? Ought our hearts be right in our thankfulness, in our receiving those? When we realize that all the good gifts that we receive and enjoy are completely undeserved, that too humbles and orients us. And the result is that we are more apt to receive still more blessings in the end. If you are at a feast full of grateful people, the atmosphere is sweet, even if the meal is scanty. From Passover to Thanksgiving, and those are different times, places, different stories. Feasts themselves recognize the existence of a giver. Thanksgiving presupposes somebody who's to whom you're giving thanks. And when we feast, we recognize the we recognize and praise the provision of God. When we feast, we are recognizing the provision of God and celebrating it. And so feasting that is formidable does this on purpose, does this with intention and joy, where the focus is on the giver of those good things to us. I'll also mention this in the next piece, but a feature of this is singing the right songs in cooperation with your feasting also is a good way to orient us as to who the giver of the good gifts actually is. So then, unsurprisingly, formidable feasters are jovial because they know that laughter is war. That's the motto of our school, and it's also a good orienting motto for life. Joviality is an outflow of thankfulness and generosity. They all go together like the ingredients of a chocolate chip cookie. Without it, the world won't care a whit about our feasting. If you cannot be jovial in your feasting, why would they want to do what you're doing? That is not compelling at all. They will not care about our feasting. They will not care about the receiving, so-called, that we are doing. They will not care about our efforts to honor God through our feasting. Dour feasting is an oxymoron. There's no such thing. Whatever it is, if it's dour, it's not feasting. I think it's Ben Merkel is the one who said that you can tell if the feasting's being done right if transitioning to the inclusion of the singing of psalms is natural. So if you can move right into singing psalms as a feature of your festivities, then you're doing it well. Now, that does not necessarily mean that if you don't sing psalms, you're not feasting, but it at least shouldn't be awkward if you try. Right? So singing psalms of praise to God should not be out of place with the sort of feasting that we're talking about. People, the world will not understand this. And in many cases, the fact that they don't care that much is more of a testament to our doing it badly than it is to their spiritual deadness. I mean, it's impossible to separate the two, but their disinterest from the fact that they don't love God. But I mean, even if they don't love God, if we're doing it well, it should at least make them curious. So formidable feasters must be ready to sing. They must be jovial. And that's what, that sort of sixfold picture is what formidable feasters look like. I told you the second I would look at features of formidable feasting. We're going to do that now. And I want to then return to the definition provided to us by Merriam-Webster and break it down or apply just a little bit. The first, you may recall, was causing fear, dread, or apprehension. Something that is formidable causes fear, dread, or apprehension. Formidable feasting, then, does the same. The presence of the formidable feaster provokes fear in his enemies. Of a degree. And so, of course, this all presupposes the existence of somebody to actually be threatened by your feasting. If you love God, and if you belong to Christ, you have enemies. Whether you acknowledge that or not, whether you like to think about that or not, it is not something that you get to escape. It is a reality, and no matter how often or how little we actually think about them. But thinking about the devil himself, a pretty simple illustration, it's not hard to imagine why the devil would be threatened or cranky if we are gathering to consciously receive good gifts from God and to honor him through that receiving. Why was David so intimidating to his enemies? Because God was with him. When God wasn't with him, David didn't do well. And we know from the early chapters of 1 Samuel that as a person, I mean, yes, he was courageous. When he was alone in the desert as a youth, he killed the bear. Yes. But really, he was not compelling. When he was anointed and when God was with him, he was formidable. If we will be marked by these things, we must plead with God to be with us, and we must work to cultivate holiness, a love for him, so that that is evident. God would come and go in the Old Testament in, by way of his Spirit, and David prayed that in Psalm 51, take not your Spirit from me, and he will not take his Spirit from us. That is a permanent gift, but God does the work. God does the work. And so we are at his mercy to be with us and then effect in us this sort of formidable capacity to feast. And now, just like the wide receiver who can work on his routes or work on his hand strength, there are things that we can do. And we need to work to be the sort of people that God is with, such that when we are feasting, it elicits the right kind of fear, dread, or apprehension on the part of the enemies of God. There's an interesting scene that now the parallel here breaks down immediately because it ended badly for Israel. But you may recall in a season before Israel had a king, when Samuel was actually the judge, in chapter 4, they're under the judgment of God, and they go to war. Round 1, the Philistines win, and then they bring the Ark of God into the camp, and then they start cheering, and the Philistines hear it, and they go, oh no. What chance do we have now? Now, little did the Philistines know that at that point, Israel was being judged by God. He was about to chastise them, and he did actually give them over to the Philistines. And then the Ark of God went into the hand of the Philistines, and that was bad for them too, and that's the scene where Dagon falls down before the Ark and all the rest. But at least the Philistines had it right. That is, when they hear the merrymaking and the presence of God with the people of God, then the effect on the part of our adversary should be a, oh no. Oh no. I would much rather be on that side than this one. Formidable feasting appropriately causes fear, dread, or apprehension. When the enemies of God see or hear worshipers praising him, it understandably makes them nervous. At least it should. Conversely, consider for a moment, what if the enemies of God were completely disinterested in what we were doing? What if they were glad that we were assembling? Why would that be? Because they think that our worship is completely impotent, or God is not. And if the enemy is not threatened, his focus and his attention will be elsewhere. Webster also says that something that is formidable has qualities that discourage approach or attack, just like those Philistines were discouraged from approaching or attacking Israel. I suggest that some such qualities as those that we just discussed, stoutness, thankfulness, joviality, and so on, are the sorts of things that we're talking about here. Those are the qualities that discourage approach or attack. And it is part of why the motto, laughter is war, is so potent for us at the school, is because joyful warriors are actually hard to beat for a couple of reasons. But among them is they have a deep-rooted optimism because they're on the winning side and it's settled. So joviality, thankfulness, the rest, generosity, those will effect in us an affect that discourages approach or attack. The feaster who is feasting formidably enjoys an orientation of his loves and of his fears. So feasting well orients our loves and fears. It orders them rightly. It's also part of how it is a tool that we can use to build, is feasting orders our loves and our fears. If the feaster is feasting well, he's not worried about outside threats. And another thing that's worth observing is that feasters are rarely alone. Just like soldiers on the battlefield, feasters enjoy a sort of strength in numbers. Singing psalms alone in the car is a healthy devotional practice. Singing psalms with your people in church, at the city park, that's warfare. Which party is more vulnerable? The one alone or the one with many? Which is more formidable? Webster also says that something that is formidable tends to inspire awe or wonder. It is impressive. Now, we might call that jealousable. It provokes curiosity, wonder, and then makes those who don't enjoy the blessings that we are receiving want the blessings that we are receiving. And just like it is Christian faithfulness to boast in the Lord, because in your boasting, you're not talking about yourself, you're talking about the giver of the good things you're enjoying. Likewise, feasting is not about the feaster nearly as much as it is about the provider of the feast. So it ought not to be confused. This should not be confused with admiration, because it's not like they look on and then they love us. Our enemies don't get the warm fuzzies when they see us praising God. The stout, jovial man is not easily rattled. The prodigious, copious man is not easily caught off guard. The thankful man is not easily discouraged or distracted. But the unbeliever looking on will understand none of that. So it will impress him, ideally, if he's paying attention, but he won't understand it. And perhaps, he'll be given to ask. So now that, imagine amassing this group of feasters. Formidable feasters, what happens? What happens at that table? Maybe somewhere, maybe in Marysville, maybe tonight. There's a small knot of fearful Christians who are assembled together, nibbling away guiltily on stale peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and praying earnestly that they would not enjoy it too much, lest it become a sort of gluttonous idolatry. The devil has made a mental note to deal with them later, because they're not a problem right now. At the moment, he's distracted by a merry group across town enjoying their peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, similar cuisine to the first one. They're even every bit as stale, with laughter and song. The lights are on and the windows are open. The passersby crane their necks to see what the big deal is. Which of these do you think poses the greater curiosity to a dying world? Which of these causes greater anxiety to the devil? Which of these offers something on which you can build? Which of these feasting parties understands better the sense of Ecclesiastes 9:7? Go, eat your peanut butter and jelly with joy, and drink your wine, your glass of milk, with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Well, just because you're a receiver doesn't mean you're not a force to be reckoned with. And God is dispensing blessings all over the place. There are particular blessings in store that land in the lap of the faithful. And those who feast well are well positioned to receive those blessings from God. These people are both a threat to their enemies as well as an aroma from life to life to those who are being saved. Our formidable feasting will not only be a feature of a jealous community we want to build, but it will also help us to get there from here. Let's pray together. Father, make us like this, we pray. And we do recognize that it is not about the peanut butter and jelly or the pizza or the steak. Or the macaroni and cheese, or the cold cereal. It is about our heart's orientation. And if we can actually be deeply and genuinely grateful for whatever it is that you give, that is a gift, and then that makes us hard to beat by your grace. And we pray that as we do faithfully boast, as we do receive well, we would not do so to puff ourselves up. We would not do so because of any sense of self-importance, but rather because you are kind. So we pray that you'd help us to find good and clear application, even as we have opportunity to discuss now. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. So leave time for questions. And if you don't have questions, I'll make you ask questions, because I've got some for you. Okay, I'll get the party started. Why did I not talk about more? Actually, I did reference a handful of foods, but I didn't really talk about any menus. Why not?
You said it's about the nail.
It's not about the nail. It's not about the food. I mean, it is about the food, but it's more about the people and the fellowship and the attitude of gratitude and the joyfulness and the gratefulness and all of that laughter and fun in the face of the enemy.
Yeah, which of the two can the world ape? The menu is easy to mimic. Maybe in some cases the world has better food than us, but just like part of why I love Thanksgiving so much, because they have to try really hard, the secularists do, to have a thankful attitude toward the cosmos for aligning properly in such a way as to spontaneously generate a turkey for me. No, rather, we're giving a nod to the giver of good gifts. So, while they can eat turkey, we can eat turkey. They don't love the giver, we do. Yeah. Fantastic. Really good question, Reva. Give us some more. Yes, sir. Mr. Harsh.
Oh, live stream. Hello, everyone joining us online. Hey, I've read Proverbs 17:1, but the feasting you're talking about is very different from the feasting that's better is a dry morsel with quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. I know that you said you can't have dour feasting. This seems like a different kind of feasting, like you could use the word music in a couple of different settings, and they could be totally different types of music. How would you unpack this particular passage?
Yeah, feasting is not... I am offering a different sort of working definition for the kind of feasting that we're trying to practice and have be a feature, like a building block for culture, because obviously the idea of feasting is not unique to the Judeo-Christian tradition. It is not unique. It's not unique to us at all. It's just what was happening in pagan mead halls, or what was happening in a house without thankfulness or fellowship, may be called feasting. It's just not the feasting I'm talking about. So what they're talking about there is a bounteous meal with strife. No thanks. I'd rather have that stale peanut butter and jelly with friends and singing. Right.
I'm trying to think of how to word this. It's always been a little bit of a disconnect for me in some ways. So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on it. Like when you say formidable feasting provokes fear in our enemies, are you speaking both in a spiritual sense, like those watching from the spiritual realm? Because I think what we would be used to is inviting in the enemies, the unbelievers, to feast with us and to show them Christ in that way. And a lot of our feasting is done behind closed doors where people may not even know we're in there feasting. So I'm wondering if you could just expand on that thought of, you know, provoking fear in our enemies, when a lot of what we do is with the body, and justifiably so, you know, eating together, drinking together, but then how that translates into those in the outside world who may not even be able to see through the wall at what we're doing.
There's actually a lot of facets to what you just talked about. Yeah, like on one hand, what is the point of trying to live what we call jealousably if not to provoke the right sort of people with the right kind of jealousy? And then ultimately unto the fullness of the Gentiles, we want for them to want what we have, not because we're awesome, but because God is. And there's a whole other category of people who are actually bona fide enemies of God who are never going to be saved. Now, we don't know who they are. We evangelize them. We give the gospel freely, broadly. But still, until the very end, God will have enemies, and then finally death will be defeated. And so in a spiritual sense, yes, but also in a real sense. I think that you see it in the news, there are a lot of secularists who just can't understand what it is about those blasted Christians that drives them bonkers. But there was a great deal of spiritual warfare going on during the COVID shutdowns, and we know that now. We knew it then. You can see it even more clearly now, but it came as no surprise to me, even in the moment, that the BLM riots and the rest happened while so many congregations were not assembling on the regular, praying for their communities, and then sharpening one another, growing in Christ's likeness, and beholding Christ together. So what happens in the churches has ripple effects outside, whether they see it, whether they like it. It just is. So there are going to be some who just hate what we're doing, whether they can say why in any sort of intelligent way or not. They're going to hate it. And then there are others and then in the spiritual realms, absolutely. We know that there's no reason to suspect that demons would ever be excited about what we do here on Sunday mornings or evenings. Or what you all do around your dinner table. Like they hate that. So yes, in a spiritual sense, absolutely. But also, I would say, in a more tangible, real sense too.
We have physical neighbors to this property who are mad about singing and playing. You have at your house next door neighbors who are mad about singing and laughing and playing noises. Not about rap music with fast words being played at ridiculous volumes. Not about cat fighting or people fighting or gunshots or whatever. Like, we're not blaring anything. It's human voices singing songs, playing games, laughing, and having good fellowship that actually has gotten the police called.
This is true.
That has gotten you, like, from this property, that has, gotten you page-long text messages from neighbors. So, like, the goal is not to... These are also people who then have been invited to come and see what it's like. And so far, it continues to really provoke them the wrong way.
Yeah, it's not hypothetical.
Yeah.
Yes, Madeline?
So, it really stuck out to me when you were talking about being thankful feasters, and I find that we exercise that term a lot in our family. Who in your life sets the greatest example of a thankful feaster, and how do they do this?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it is perhaps a kindness from the Lord that nobody stands out. What I mean is that in micro, and we're looking to try to grow this, I actually get to spend well over 90% of my time around Christians. So I happen to be one whose work enables me to spend around people who, like me, love the Lord and who are actually trying to advance the same things from a mission standpoint that I am too. So while it is an area where we can continue to grow, I do spend a lot of time at the school with people for whom an attitude of merriment is something we are constantly working on. So to have, because again, I'm not trying to say like we've got it dialed, we actually need to grow in this, but I do, between a lot of the students and like all of the teachers, get to be with people who have a feasting mindset on the regular. And how do they do that? By laughing heartily at a scanty meal. And with that said, we need to get better and excel still more so that is more consistent in our interactions across the board, not just with one another, with students, but at home with our families, with our neighbors, when we are out in the world. I don't mean to be vague there. I can't think of a person who just leaves everybody else in the dust in terms of enfleshing thankful feasting. I guess...
in terms of homes that have left everybody else in the dust on inviting people over to their house to be hospitable to them with feasting, that would be your house. So your household's efforts to invite people in to share some of that on a diligent, planned, purposeful basis. Like, I think you have... Your household has left the rest of our household
well, thanks for that. Yes, sir.
First of all, Dad, you're doing a great job getting the mic. Sure, the people at home loving hearing just parts of that.
Thank you. You're doing a great job of respecting your father.
Yeah. That's why I said good job. So Mr. Sar, in terms of like your house being one of those, your house has also had... Not just this property has had the cops called. Your house has had the cops called from neighbors. And
I don't think we've actually had the cops called, have we?
You will hear.
We did. Yeah, we did. We did. Yeah, here we did. Uh-huh.
But your neighbor has... Was it a threat or...
This is a lot of words.
Yeah. But so in terms of... So we get... you know, we can look at negative feedback on our feasting at about, most of the time, it's about 100% of it, it's false feedback. Are there lines where, you know, parents are not actually paying enough attention to their kids, or it is actually just being obnoxious? I'm not saying that we're doing that, but... Do you think there are some lines that, like, you've thought of before, or what some of those ditches would be? Because we do still want to be pleasant, even if we are loud. But what do you think there are some lines, and where would those be?
Yeah, well, Jocko says that discipline equals freedom, right? So, I mean, I was looking for a way to squeeze Jocko into it. When feasting, yeah, right, no. But I believe that feasting is a Christian discipline. And just because it's a discipline doesn't mean it's not fun. So there are absolutely, and you know, 1 Corinthians, we're exhorted to do all, whether it's a liturgy in church or beyond that, the principle applies to do things in an orderly fashion. So just as feasting is not just partying, so it is. Hospitality needs to be a feature of it on the part of the host and on the part of the guest, and that. So when I mentioned that a receiver with a formidable feaster has a thankful heart, he can be a means of blessing to the giver by how he receives. The same thing can happen if you go over to somebody's house and turn your kids loose. And they destroy the home of the person that you're visiting. That is violating the spirit of hospitality as a guest. It does not mean that you need to have your child actually on a chain either. That would be bad. So like so many things, just because it is joyful, fun, and free does not mean that it is without any sort of structure or boundary. And then also a heart of hospitality does give consideration to all parties. And that means that when you are the guest, you are thinking about how to make your host's life a delight too. So it goes both ways. If we are having... Now, there are going to be times where it is, okay, let's just, the kids are free to run around the rooftop, the fences are high. But generally speaking, practicing wisdom is in order, and that doesn't need to come at the cost of those different attributes that we talked about here. I don't think that's any. In fact, to a watching world, that's going to provoke even more curiosity. Wow. So you the stories are legion of. What was I think? I heard an anecdote about the Fight Laugh Feast conference being in Nashville or something like that, and they said, "I've never seen so many people drink so much beer and not get drunk." You know, they're just making merry and having a great time, and then the world is like, "That doesn't square with my experience." You know, so if we can make merry, if we can have fun, if we can feast and do so in a controlled fashion at the same time. Like they'll say, how do you do it?
Okay, so if feasting is a big way we're commending the works of the Lord to the next generation by showing them how to do it, that's obviously one big way. So showing them how to be grateful receivers ourselves. But that comes with being a grateful giver as well and training them how to do that. And it involves being sturdy as kids do weird stuff, like try to help each other feast.
And you're saying for children to be grateful givers, is that what you said?
Yeah, uh-huh. As we train them to do that, what are your best hot tips for dad's comfort about for parents to make themselves sturdy as their kids are learning how to give and receive and doing it really awkwardly or in ways that involve a lot of what looks like waste?
Well, that's a good question, and at least if I understand the question correctly, and I think, and any of the other parents are welcome to chime in, I will give a simple answer that I try to practice. That is, actually be excited when your kids give you stuff. Recognizing that I mean, at this stage in her life, I think that giving things away is Julia's way of throwing things away. So, which is something she doesn't want anymore. She goes, no, it's for you. It's like, oh, thanks so much. It's clearly precious. So to try to affirm a spirit of generosity in the bud and just not being too fussy, then you can do things like, that was really thoughtful. Can I help you beautify it a little bit? So then do it with them, and then make it even more special. Then they have buy-in, it actually looks better, and it's something that's more worth giving. What other hot tips from you parents? There's a lot of parents in the room. How do you cultivate a spirit of generous and thankful giving in your children? Fair to say, Maggie? Am I doing that justice?
Not a plate full of food that they could actually eat, but a plate full that the entire family could eat. So I think a lot of it is the parents going along with their kids as they are learning to receive and to give, and giving advice, learning, parents being involved. Like when you get in a group, are you free from your kids? You know, because now you get to spend time, sort of like even being here at church. Are you free from your kids? You get to talk to other adults that you don't get to see very often. And meanwhile, your kids are learning to grow on their own.
Tasmanian
or at the behest
devils.
Of their friends. Yeah. So I think it's the parents being cognizant that little kids still need a lot of hands-on advice and cautionary kind of conversations as it's going on.
Well, you got the microphone. You were next anyway, so.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
We do a lot of evaluating, like in leadership. We get the questionnaire of 1 to 10, how are we doing? How do you think as a body we are doing in the feasting area?
I think we're pretty good. I think we're pretty good with some room to grow. But I think, too, that trying to be intentional about it is, like, I don't know anywhere else that talks about feasting like this, like literally. I do know that, and I appreciate this about some of the folks over in Moscow, where feasting is a part of their culture. That is really good, but they for them it is they're further along down the road, and they talk about it like you and I would talk about breathing. Right? It's just it's more natural. So for us, we're trying to forge a mindset and where we actually do these things on purpose rather than they're happening to us. And so it, because of that, I think the frame of reference is very, very limited. But there's a part of me that wants to say, in some ways, we're off the charts, just because what's the comparison? If by how well we're doing, does everybody get what we do? No, I don't think so. I think it is more a, well, that's pleasant. I think I like what's coming from the room I'm in. I don't know how it got here. I don't know how to manufacture it. I don't know how to make it happen next week. But and so to that degree, we have some work to do. But for where we are on the timeline, where we are in terms of this generational work, I think there's lots of reason to be encouraged. Any of the other elders are welcome to chime in or give a 7.24.
No, I'm kidding. Going back to your first question that you proposed.
Yeah, about the menu or whatever.
Yep. About the menu. Does the menu matter? I don't think we would say like flavor doesn't matter or quality doesn't matter, in the sense of even like it's the state of the heart that matters when we're singing, and yet we get together to learn to sing better. We want to sing with competence.
Yep.
We want to be skillful in our worship. The Bible calls us to do so. And in a similar way, for our meal preparations, for our aesthetics on the table, right, all of that, for that to be pleasing to the eyes, to the smell, to the taste, all of that, we would think is important, and we would want to grow more and more in that. And so even when Proverbs talks about, better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fattened ox with hatred with it or whatnot, that kind of conditional comparison, but the best is a fattened ox and love, right?
Yep.
So how would we balance that with not being pretentious and persnickety and fussy and picky about these minute details? How do we care about flavor and competence and doing a good job on the skill level of feasting while not ruining all the fun in it all as well?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And it's easier said than done. And I think it's about cultivating gratefulness. Because if you are grateful, then that is going to cover a whole host of mediocrity sins. Now, I there is a sense in which the menu doesn't matter, but I also said that a steak is more compelling than a Big Mac. So there are things that we can do to make feasting sweet. And so, yes, it is more important, and it is harder work for our hearts to be right. But then, provided the heart is right, go overboard. Like, make it awesome. Make it beautiful. It's aesthetically pleasing. It's pleasing to all of the senses. It smells wonderful. It tastes delightful. Like, ribeye is better than London broil. It just is. I mean, and you know, sirloin's in between there somewhere. There are some things. So there's times for the $2 chuck, which is now like what, $4 chuck? I don't know, inflation. And there's times for a really nice Cabernet. You know, absolutely. What we talk about as a family with our dinners on Saturday nights, for instance, is getting a running start of Sunday morning, and the and and and, you know, giving mints on Sundays so the Sundays are sweet. Corporate worship is sweet. We want for it to be something that is alluring, appetizing. And I think the idea is that it's alluring and appetizing not because of the chocolate, but because the chocolate is received with a grateful heart. So that's why I said it's easier said than done. The idea is help your kids to be thankful, model thankfulness yourself, like be genuinely thankful, be spent, all those gospel principles, if I jump in and do more than my share of the cleanup, aren't the kids just going to take advantage of that? What if they do, once in a while? Like, if that is a norm every day, that's bad. But if it is a big-hearted effort to practice the gospel and to give, like God does to us, then that is going to have its effect over time. So I think you scratched a number of things, but the biggest is just to practice and then try to cultivate thankfulness. Then when it is a Sabbath dinner of macaroni and cheese, it's like, this is a big party. This is good. There's times for that too.
You kind of touched on this in a couple questions, but when teaching a child to be grateful or to give, to be generous, is it more effective to ask things from them or to give to them? Because I can think of like a rebuttal to both of those, that someone's like, well, if you ask for things from your children, aren't you teaching them to be needy? And it's like, well, if you're giving your children so many things, aren't you making them a spoiled brat? And obviously, it seems like it would be a balance, but how would you do that, part A? Also, part B is then when you are around people who are not children, who you're not directly in charge of, and you're just trying to share with them this culture, how would you apply that? So, like, asking things from or giving?
Yeah, I would just say that there's a place for both. There's a place for both. For little tiny guys, I mean, ask, oh, that's really cool, you know, Spider-Man action figure, may I see it? And he lets you see it. And then, hey, thanks for sharing, and then give it back. Don't say thank you very much and run away. hey, I said thank you. I mean, I'm teaching in thankfulness. But then when they do give, you affirm and praise that, hey, you did something really, really good there. Coaching in terms of sharing with playmates, like, hey, this is how it works. For our kids, part of the deal when they have friends come over, unless the parents of the kids who come over want their kids helping to clean up after themselves, we say, you are free to go. This is part of the deal. We want to train our kids that this is the way it works. You have people over, you clean up after them. So we totally got this. If you want to train your kid to help clean up after himself, by all means, go ahead. But otherwise, you guys do not need to feel any obligation to stick around. So all of those sorts of things have their place. I don't know. The frame of the child changes as the child develops. To, you know, when does a child start understanding what it's like to be giving away and never getting it back? Like, you know, I'm giving you a gift. So he does know what it's like to grow up in a culture where that's a norm. So where that is a normal feature, where he sees generosity practiced, it is definitely not always the case that translates, but it does a lot. And then the second part was with regard to adults, and then ask the question again.
It was just the same thing, and how do you communicate that kind of culture to someone else? But it seems like when I was thinking about adults, I'm like, okay, well, it seems more obvious that it would be that you would just give to them and that they would understand that better if you just kept giving and giving, and that they would take that differently than a child would. But how, because you probably wouldn't invite someone over and then you're like, I'm really going to show them what generosity is like because they're not used to that, and so I'm going to ask to borrow their car or something like that. Yeah, but so would you say that showing moving past showing a child, but showing an adult or someone your own age generosity, that you would just keep giving to them in a myriad of ways?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think if I understand the question correctly, I think with an older person, I'd be more inclined to just model it without any strings attached, and then leave the, I mean, because God does that with us all the time. So then let it have its effect. And there's no guarantee that it will, but that's okay, because it's more blessed to give than to receive. So part of it is to fix your own heart, to make it so that you're actually okay just giving, just blessing, without, so don't enter in like it's a transaction. I'm not expecting anything in return for this. I'm just giving. And then you'll find that not only are you happier, but they're probably likely to be more grateful.
One more thing on the kids' part is you can actually give them money to give as a gift. So that's the combination of it. Combination platter. So like you got a regular gift, a regular income, and you're like, hey kids, all of you are getting a certain amount of this, and your job is to figure out who you want to bless with this. Or even if they get a regular amount of income in part of their budget, okay, so 10% is going to be giving, 40% is going to be saving, actually another 10% we want you to set aside for gifts that you're going to give later at birthdays or Christmases, yeah, or whatever for your friends. And then you get the other part for your spending. So in their budget, from what they earn, or even just providing them with opportunities, say, hey, this is a family project. You can think about what you want to do with this. Who you're going to bless.
That's good.
One more part that I just thought of. So, with gratefulness and teaching gratefulness, it would seem more applicable to really young people. But should we be concerned that when there's an abundance of gift that you will lose gratefulness? So like saying if you got your children 20 Christmas presents instead of 3, or if you gave them so many dessert options instead of 1, or if you gave, like if you presented more options that they might forget about some of the other ones, should we be concerned about that at all, or just load it up?
You should absolutely be concerned about it, but from my experience, there is no hard and fast connection related to it. If you give them more than 2 gifts, they're not going to be thankful for them. People can be miserly with no money or miserly with a lot of money. Little kids can be grabby and stingy with lots of gifts, or with few gifts. They can be deeply grateful for 100 gifts or none. So that sounds like a Christian cop-out, but it actually is more about cultivating genuine gratefulness. And I don't know. Generally, at Christmas time, we go big, that is because the advent of Christ is a big deal, and we want them circling that on their calendar for the rest of their lives. The lead up, the 4 weeks leading up, and then same day. You know, so. Birthdays, we don't go nearly as big at birthdays, but really the heart behind it is what's more important than the actual stuff. Yes, Reva?
I think on that note, real quick, is gifting children, especially little ones, lots of things is the secret, is like giving them time to enjoy and savor each one as they are receiving it. I don't know. That's just a side note. But back to clarifying my food doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It does. But the thing is, like, don't let the food be the block to the feasting, right? Like, I have feasted amazingly on lentil stew, and I have feasted amazingly on steaks, and presented, you know, things of different levels. And, you know, like we were invited, Philip and Nelia are a great example of this, because they invited us over for a little dessert. And it was like the most amazing smorgasbord table full of all the sweet and savory things you could ever imagine. And it made me rethink what it is to present a bountiful gift to friends. And sometimes I do only have brownies, but they presented a whole new opportunity for me to think about it in that way. But lentils are great too.
They can be.
I was just thinking about discussion about example and how you lead by example. And certainly our attitudes are a big one. But also as you're raising little ones and modeling, and modeling prayer and teaching them how to pray, teaching them how to pray with a thankful heart for the little things as well as the big things is really, I think, helpful to frame their perspective as they then go about their day, seeing opportunities for, like, reflecting in their own heart about how they can be thankful for things that they see that are small or big. So I would say, like, family prayer time, discussion time, like, where do you see God showing up? You know, what can you be thankful for? Because sometimes you get in kind of a rut and it's really hard to see. Or you had a really bad day and it's hard to think about, what am I thankful for? Like, where did I see God? But if it is like a regular practice and discussion, then that, I think, bubbles up into their prayer life. And then you can really hear where they're thankful, or maybe opportunities to cultivate more thankfulness. Because if they're just always, you know, kind of perfunctory prayers or not specific, like, there's an opportunity to have discussion and drill down into that a little bit more.
That's a good word. So as we talk about formidable feasting, you mentioned that the neighbors around us don't see it as jealousable. So as we have that vision to be formidable, how do we spill into other parts of the community other than just the local neighbors here?
That's the question. How do we do it? So here, there is, Jim, I think, was one of the first I heard pray for it to, for us to be an unignorable presence in Marysville. And that's, I like that, and that presupposes a couple of things. That there is something that they can't ignore if they want to, and then that they're at least paying attention enough to not ignore. So there's a couple of things there. We remain, I think that what we have is pretty great and worth trying to export, even though we are recipients of grace. So whatever we have is awesome, and it's not actually because of us. I can say that without the slightest hesitation. Our boasting would be in the Lord, and He has given us some really great things that He will give to you too. For that, we remain a pretty well-kept secret. So I think we have some work to do. But I do think the needle is moving the right way, little by little, as some of it happens, and just as we do things here, but as we export our worldview in our different cul-de-sacs and communities and spheres of influence, we do it at the school as well. And so then, ideally, some of the same sort of mission worldview philosophy pieces would trickle out into other churches too. So it's nowhere near as fast as we would like, no doubt. But I do think it's happening little by little. You put your finger on a weakness.
Remember, as we're seeking to be jealous, there's two kinds of people in the non-Christian world: those who are yet to be saved and those who will never be saved. We're going to always irritate those who are never going to be saved. And so some of your neighbors may always hate. You could be the most jealousable Christian ever. They're just going to hate it, and so be it. But then there are those who are being saved. Now, those who are being saved may look like those who will never be saved for a while. So we never know who's never going to be saved until they die, and then it becomes evident. And so we just continue to live our lives, live the Jezebel life, and let it manifest itself in their lives, but however it's going to manifest, just so you make sure we're not being jerky, but if people are going to be mad at us for singing happy birthday in a parking lot, that's their deal, not ours. So,
all right, well, good questions. We can put a pin on it, or put a pin in it, put a bow on it, or mix metaphors. Let's stand together.
Amen. Have a great week. Peace. Well.